Yes. No, it's all right. Just a few questions, please. All right. Well, then you're an old timer. Okay, Deborah.
May I please report, Ms. Pamela Walker will argue for appellant, Mr. Robert Christian will argue for the state.
All right.
May I please report? I'm Pamela Walker, and I'm here today representing Joseph David King, who was convicted in December of 2008 of aggravated sexual assault of a child and sentenced to mandatory sentence to life in prison. I was hired by Mr. King in an appellate posture to represent him in this appeal, and of course you have before you my brief and listing the different aspects I am asking this court respectfully to address. In particular, I would ask that the court address the request for a motion for a continuance that was offered orally by the trial attorney, James Weingartner, the morning literally seconds before the jury was brought in for opening statements to begin. The jury had been selected the day before. They were starting the next morning. Based upon questions asked by Mr. Weingartner during the voir dire process, Mr. Christian, the district attorney, indicated that if Mr. Weingartner was going to attempt a strategy, a defense strategy, involving certain particular areas involving the mother of the child, problematic issues involving the mother of the child, that other aspects that would otherwise not be admissible, including a 23-year-old conviction of the appellant in, I believe, the state of Minnesota that resulted in a 10-year probation, which he successfully completed, of improper touching, sexually molesting of one of his children. According to Mr. Christian's resuscitation to the judge, that, Your Honor, if he brings up any of these things, the mother's drug use, CPS involvement, other areas of concern, then we will bring forward why we believe her problems were caused by what happened 25 years earlier. At that point, Mr. Weingartner, you can tell from the written record, was completely surprised. They had, this case had been awaiting a trial date for about 2 years, and there had been discussion between Mr. Weingartner and Mr. Christian. This completely caught Mr. Weingartner off guard. He immediately requested a continuance, explaining to the judge that if I am unable to present my defense, then I need time to create another defense. Now, in the response brief by Mr. Christian, he indicates and even cites some cases that you have to tell the judge what this plan B could be or how long it would take, how long you will need. In this case, there was no plan B. They were going to have to go back, re-examine the entire situation on how best at that point to protect the interests of Mr. Kane and put on the most effective defense strategy possible if this strategy that had been planned for all this time was not going to be permitted. There were times in the case where he attempted to ask questions, particularly of the victim, Michael Wilbur, that the judge refused to allow him to even ask the questions regarding CPS or other issues that resulted in the situation that brought the family living together again under one roof. Now, in...
Are you telling us that the defense counsel didn't know about this prior conviction?
That I absolutely he did. But the conviction was of another child, not of the mother of the child that was the victim, the outcry victim in this case. And again, they had allowed bygones to be bygones. This was the second time that the mother and the children had moved in with the appellant and his wife.
What's the surprise?
The surprise was the entire defense was going to be the mother was going to have the children taken away in Longview by CPS. To keep that from happening, she agreed to move in with her father, her stepmother, go to work for her father, and be supervised by the parents.
Under what theory was that going to be admissible? That remote, extremely remote old conviction, under what theory was it going to be even admissible?
Well, the contention of the district attorney was all of the prostitution, drug problems, inability to maintain a job, inability to take care of her children, all went back, according to the DA, to the issues surrounding her, her sister, and the father 25 years before. So if you're going to say that the mother, Janine, had all these problems, then you have to show why they said that this is all because the father possibly did this to Janine.
The father wasn't convicted of doing anything to Janine.
That is correct. That is exactly correct. And when the James Weingartner voiced his displeasure, his surprise, his shock, in the transcript, the judge, although he did not specifically deny the motion for continuance, he implicitly denied the motion for continuance by saying, I'll have to deal with this as this comes up, then we'll know where we'll go from there, bring in the jury. And under 3301, subpart 1A or 2A, that you can implicitly deny a request for a continuance that is made orally by continuing with the trial, which is what the judge did in this case. So the attorney, who is very experienced, had no opening statement. He had no time to even formulate any other kind of alternative plan if he was not going to be able to say, look, she came, she lived with us. Look, we took care of her. Look, she went back to using drugs. The day I told her, you got to take a drug test, she was gone 2 days later. They were gone. They moved back to Longview a couple of weeks later. Then about 8 months later, CPS is back in Janine's life, and all of a sudden, you can't take my kids because my father molested my son. And we wanted the ability to show the jury this is the sequence of events at least it raises a possibility that the mother influenced this child in order to try to keep her family together. Nothing else was said. And if we could, on the second issue, was main issue I'd like to address is the closing statement, closing argument by Rob Christian, the DA, and in that statement that he made, there were arguments and statements made that a jury listening easily could have seen as only the defendant could have answered this question. That in addition, he made comments about what do these people know that we don't know, which was in violation of the motion in limine. It indicates, insinuates there's something else there that perhaps you don't know about. We're not asking for a perfect trial for Mr. Kane, but we do feel in this case he was not given the chance for a fair, open trial that was properly prepared for and everything done possible to give him a chance to fight these awful allegations that were made against him. And again, in my brief, I've listed what the DA claimed and stated.
Ms. Walker, the statement you just referred to, talking about what these other people might know, that was not a statement addressed towards what the defendant might know. It was talking about other people who testified, isn't that correct?
Well, in saying, what do these people know that you don't know? Yes. And in the same context, there were three or four issues that he discussed that at least opened the door to the possibility of making it even more clear to this jury. We never heard from him. We never heard from him. Had he testified, then maybe we would have gotten the answers to these questions that we don't have, that other parties that were called were unable to answer. And it really brought forward and home to the jury that he didn't testify.
You've mentioned the fact that there were questions that the defense was not allowed to ask. But that's not a point on appeal.
And Your Honor, and for that, all I can tell you is when I was preparing for this and going through the questions that Mr. Weingartner asked Michael Wilbur, even just trying to show the jury CPS was heavily involved in their lives. And Janine, his mother, my mouth is real dry, was trying to keep CPS out of their lives, that the minute he asked those questions, there was an objection, the objection was sustained, and he had to move on. He couldn't even let the jury know, we were staying with my grandfather because if we didn't, CPS was going to separate us. We had to do what CPS wanted us to do so we could stay together as a family. And that was the second time that they had moved in with this couple, Mr. Kane and his wife. And there was absolutely no outcry, no discussion, no mention, anything until 6 to 8 months later when CPS came back into their lives, none of which we could bring out because the judge wouldn't let us present evidence on the strategy that was designed to be presented.
Did the judge allow you to make an offer of proof?
There was a bill of exceptions that was done that I did go through in my brief, again explaining to the best of their ability that CPS was involved, and yes, that is contained in the brief.
And to which point that you which issue that you've raised, do we attach this? I mean, there's no separate issue regarding the inability to present the defense.
Only from the standpoint, I see what you're saying. I'm sorry, it is contained within the denial of the motion for continuance on the morning the trial started. That's when James Weingartner said, then, Your Honor, I need a continuance. Now, I know it says it's not sworn. He is an officer of the court. He'd filed a motion for continuance.
Well, this is during the trial, though, isn't there?
Exactly.
There's a different rule for the ones that are pretrial and the ones that are during trial.
Correct.
The ones that are during trial don't have to be verified. They don't have to be lying.
And he made immediately, I mean, there was no hesitation. If you're going to cut my legs out from under me, this is my... It just turned red. I'm not sure. Does that mean I just quit?
Just finish your sentence.
Okay. That he had no alternative. Again, there was no plan B set up. They had everything lined up. And it wasn't something where he could say, well, Your Honor, I need to line up witnesses then for plan B. He didn't have a plan B. Their strategy was solid, and it was good. And it was ready to go up until that point.
Do you have any other questions?
Now, the strategy was, in fact, to attack the credibility of the testimony of the child.
Testimony of the child only from the input from the mother.
Yeah, testimony of the child and the mother was the strategy that you're saying that you were not allowed to pursue.
Correct.
Was we want to attack the credibility of the child and the mother, and this was a trial in which they were found to be believed by the
Janine never testified. They never called her.
Well, the child.
The child was the only witness, and it came out, as you can tell in the brief, that the story was very shaky. Changed. He told different people different things. I mean, it was really shaky. And that was the only...
Last thing I want to ask, Ms. Walker, is there was mention in the record in the brief that the child was dyslexic.
Yes. There was no dispute over that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob?
May it please the court. I have some advantage in that I was the trial attorney that prosecuted this case, but at a disadvantage that I have to read over some of the arguments that I made and trying to figure out exactly what they mean. But I wanted to go through really in the order that the appellant went through and first address the allegations of improper jury argument. And it's my understanding of the law that before an argument is an improper comment on the defendant's failure to testify, that it has to be an unambiguous comment on the defendant's failure to testify. And I want to go through these arguments one by one. The first argument addresses, or the first point of error addresses an argument where I talked about an interview that the defendant gave to a DPS officer. And in this interview that the defendant gave, he was asked, did you touch the anus or genitals of the, or we'll just say sexually molest the child? And at first the defendant said no, and then the defendant said, well, if I did, I don't remember. And of course, my argument was at trial is that was a statement that an innocent person wouldn't make.
Was that the question about penetration?
Yes, yes. And I think that if you read the record in a whole, that's clearly what I was referring to. And when there's an objection, he's commenting on the absence of testimony from the defendant. That's the objection. The court overrules that objection because the trial court, I think, rightly determined what the argument was. But what's not in the appellant's brief but is in the record is something I've added just to make sure that, you know, that there wasn't any confusion about what I was talking about. My next statement after this objection is, that's why when pressed from Michelle Cianci, who is the DPS person, that's why he blah, 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 blah. So I feel like, number one, this is not an improper comment on the defendant's failure to testify, number one. And number two, if the trial court was wrong, and it was, I don't feel like there's any harm because the state, the prosecutor himself, right after making this argument, clarifies that he's not talking about the failure of testimony from the defendant, but is talking about an interview that the defendant had with this Michelle Cianci. The next two, there's really two arguments, I guess, that the appellant argues about here, deals with an argument relating to the child being subject to cross-examination, talking about how the child held up under that cross-examination. The objection there is that the defendant, is that the prosecutor was trying to shift the burden of proof, which I suppose is a valid objection, but that objection was overruled. It's only in this brief, for the first time now on appeal, that the complaint is not that the prosecutor was shifting the burden of proof, but that argument was a comment on the defendant's failure to testify. And so I contend, first, that that's not preserved for review. And second, if the court does address the merits of that argument and this complaint, I again contend that it's not an unambiguous comment on the defendant's failure to testify. The last argument that I want to address is an argument, again, it's hard to argue that this argument that I made is an unambiguous statement as to anything. It is somewhat, I don't know, I really got my mouth ahead of my mind here a little bit, but in this case, it's important that the evidence was is that the trial, of course, is years after the alleged abuse, and the defense brought in other adults that were living near these people or living in the home. And their testimony is that this defendant had no access to this child, not even for a minute, ever, while the year that they lived in the home. And my contention as a prosecutor was that that was simply not credible testimony. There's no way that this defendant or anybody else living in that home could have lived there with this child and not been alone with him at least for 5 minutes. I mean, that defies common sense. And the objection was made, though, and I did say, you know, it doesn't, my argument was twofold, I suppose. First of all, this isn't true. And if it is true, it makes you wonder why this is the only person that hasn't had any contact with this child. Okay, that's the argument, as you know, and it was for what it is. The objection, though, is that it's an improper argument, it's clearly improper, and the motion in limine, the trial court sustains that objection. I will argue that that is not preserved for review. Now, for the first time, the argument is that's a comment on the defendant's failure to testify.
Okay, so the objection was sustained, the jury was instructed. Was there a motion for mistrial?
Yes, but they did pursue that to an adverse ruling. My point, though, is that the objection itself does not comport with the complaint on appeal. Yeah. So that's why I argue that it's not preserved. Again, my next argument, though, clarifies this argument that probably wasn't well thought out to begin with, and that is basically, I go back and explain, they cannot come up here and tell you that he didn't have any access to that child. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, everybody that lives in a home with a child is going to have access to that child. And that was my argument there. I don't think, even if we address the merits of this, even though the objection doesn't comport with the complaint on appeal, I just don't see that there's any harm in that argument because I do think it's a reasonable deduction from the evidence and not harmful anyway. On the second point of error, I want to talk about that a little bit because I think that it's important for the court to know some of the background of the facts here. And I think that the court is in a somewhat of a bad position, the appellate court, because so much of what was said about these background and these facts was either hearsay or just the lawyers talking about it. The record is not very well developed. But I will just say, for the purposes of understanding here, it wasn't in Minnesota. It was in East Texas. This defendant confessed to molesting his two oldest daughters. One is this Janine, is going to be the mother of the victim here, and then a younger daughter. Janine left home, and her life really kind of spiraled out of control, ended up prostituting herself. She was involved in drugs, just a real tragic situation. She's gone. They have this confession. He ends up pleading guilty to molesting the younger daughter. So it is true that he was never convicted of molesting Janine, but I do think it's important for the court to know that these things were intertwined. I mean, it was the molestation in the home of these two girls. I think that they're connected. And I'll represent to the court that, you know, we all knew, we being the trial attorneys, the prosecutor and the defense, about the history of the mother. I mean, she was a very rough character. You know, when I talked to her, I mean, I noticed she had an earring ripped out of her ear, and her earlobe was kind of cleaved. I mean, she was a rough person. We talked about this, you know, for a year, about how we're going to try this case, and how I knew that if she were to testify, and if she were to be, she would be very easily become a distraction. And that would clearly be the defensive strategy if I were defending this person. I didn't want that to happen, so much so that she's my outcry witness. I didn't even call her as a witness, okay? Although, you know, I didn't call her. Before the trial started, just stood up and told the court, and in the presence of the defense counsel, that, you know, I understand from Vore Dyer that the strategy here is going to be to try to skin up the mom and make her attack her credibility. And my contention is that if we're going to go down the road of talking about all of Janine Wilbur's problems, then I think it becomes relevant to talk about what started those problems and talk about the whole picture. And I don't think that it's fair for the defense to be able to cherry-pick these facts. We're going to talk about this fact and this fact and this fact without talking about the whole story. That was, I didn't have to do that. I could have sat back and I could have let the defense try to pursue this strategy and then stood up and said, all right, judge, now we think the door's opened, and see what the judge did. But I didn't do that. I think that in the appellant's brief, my actions are characterized as somewhat malicious or sinister. But the fact is, I think that I tipped my hand. I showed my cards. And the trial judge, and I think this is important because Justice Delfino asked several questions about the defense not being able to pursue this strategy and being prohibited from asking these questions. I said, and the trial court said, the defense can pursue whatever strategy the defense wants to. And it was just a shot across the bow, maybe, from the prosecutor's perspective, to say, look, I want everybody to know what my position is, so that when this comes in and I stand up and say that the door is open, the defense can't say, well, you know, I didn't realize I was doing that or something. I want everybody to know. And the judge said, okay.
What questions were they not allowed to ask? The appellant was arguing that there were questions that they weren't allowed to ask, and they didn't make a bill.
During the trial, the defense started calling up witnesses, and they just started talking about all this stuff, about how, you know, Janine did this and Janine did that, and the little boy said this and the little boy said that. But all that stuff in the bill was hearsay, number one. I mean, it wasn't admissible in and of itself. And nobody ever told the defendant, you can't ask these people these questions. Janine was at the courthouse. If they wanted to call her, she's there. And they could have asked her, you know, did you make your son make these allegations against your father? I mean, do you hate your father? Were you mad at your father because of he found out you were using drugs? Or whatever they wanted to ask her, they could have asked her. The judge never told the defendant, you cannot ask these questions. That is not in the record. And clearly, what happened here? Clearly, if you kind of read between the lines, and clearly the defendant wanted the judge to say what he would do if this evidence came in, and of course the trial judge didn't. I don't think that the trial judge was obligated to speculate as to what his rulings would be, you know, the next day in the trial. I knew Judge Walton, I didn't think he would. And now the defense is in the position, you know, do I roll the dice and, you know, guess that the judge is going to rule my way or not? And in this case, the defense decided that they didn't want to take that risk. And that's what's happened here. It's interesting, and I'm running out of time, but it's interesting that even the appellant said they didn't have a plan B. I mean, the delay for there to be any error, for there to be any harm, I think there has to be some threshold showing, look, either trial judge or look, appellate court, if we would have been given a delay of a day, of a week, or a month, or a year, some period of time, this is what we would have done differently. But there's none of that here. I mean, no delay is going to change the rules of evidence. No delay is going to allow them to read into the future and see what Judge Walton's going to rule on this prospective issue of this admissibility of this evidence. There's no other strategy. There simply is no harm. Real quickly on the if you guys, do you guys have any questions? You guys, sorry. Does the court have any questions about that issue?
Well, I do. What was your theory of admissibility that if there wasn't a final conviction and if she didn't testify, I think weren't they entitled to explore bias and motive on the part of the witness? What was your theory of admissibility?
Well, I had several theories. Number one, she knew that he molested her. She had problems with CPS. She put her children in the home with him. And I would suggest, and my argument was going to be, is that with all that history, she had a disincentive to report this because of her history.
So you were going to call her?
No, I'm sorry.
Then how was it coming in?
Well, I thought it was only going to come in if they called her. And they ask her, well, isn't it true that you have a bias against my client and in that why you put your son up to making these false allegations? My question would be maybe along the lines of, well, why do you have this bias? Well, it's because he molested me. And isn't it true that you do have problems with CPS? Yes, I mean, that's what they've asked me. And you have put your child in the home with a known child molester. You know, I think that creates for her a disincentive to report anything against him. Now, I don't know if it would have been admissible or not. And I'm not contending to you, I'm not defending that point. All I'm saying is that in the way this thing was tried, the appellant's trial counsel decided he didn't want to risk it and didn't present the evidence. And I think that's his call. And I think that it's within sound trial strategy and within the zone of reasonable disagreement. I just don't see that is an appellate issue in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I listened quite intently to Mr. Christian, and I'd like, and again, I know you have the record in front of you and can read for yourselves, but even simple questions that Mr. Weingartner tried to ask Michael, the victim, to try and convey to the jury that, you know, there were problems here. that resulted in you living with your grandparents, and you had to live with your grandparents, or CPS would take you, that, you know, he would say, now, at the house in Longview, were there some problems at the house? Yes, sir. Objection. Sustained. Had your mother been acting strangely? Yes. Objection. Relevant. Sustained. On an, anything that even insinuated that this mother might have an issue that would result in a benefit to her, particularly with CPS. There's testimony in during the trial, as you will see.
Before you go down the road, what issue does that go to?
Again,
does it go to erroneous trial court rulings?
What I hopefully am trying to convey is that if the judge, and he made the statement, we all know Judge Walton in Hood County, it's a very small county, the judge was not going to allow them to present the case and the defense as they had planned. And that was no secret. He was trying to get across to the jury in any way possible that the mother had a lot to lose if this was not taken care of. She was going to lose her kids. She was going to lose her welfare. She was going to lose her food stamps. It was going to go on and on.
But what point of error does that go to?
In this case, again, I believe it comes back to the motion for continuance. Give Mr. Weingartner time to reformulate a plan that can defend this poor man and give him an opportunity to present a defense. That
so you're not saying the trial court erred in not allowing him to put on the defense he had planned to put on. You're saying the trial court erred in not giving him time to come up with a different defense.
That he failed to grant the motion for continuance, even again, even for a week, to say, all right, if you want a week, it's been 2 years, what, he's out of jail, what's another week? The surprise was there was no knowledge whatsoever, and again, it's clear in the record that James Weingartner had no clue that he was, particularly since Janine was not the named victim in the previous charge against Mr. Kane, that he was not going to be able to present the bad life, the difficult life.
There was no ruling that he couldn't present. In fact, it was specifically, the judge specifically told him, you can't present it. You can put on any defense that you want to. And then if that's the case, he already knew about this previous problem. You said this wasn't a surprise. Oh, I didn't know that there had been a molestation in the past. I mean,
it seems like you're really complaining that the trial court improperly sustained the objections to the evidence that he was trying to offer, and that's not anything you've raised on appeal.
And again, for that I apologize. I've done my best here, and I genuinely do believe that this man did not receive an opportunity to present any kind of a defense that gave him any opportunity to even possibly have a jury examine and look at the facts as a whole and make a decision based upon all the information, right down to where Mr. Christian says, what do they know that we don't know? If they'd allowed us to put on our case, and of course I wasn't a trial attorney, it might all have fit together like a puzzle and given that jury an opportunity to make a decision and to decide what they wanted to believe or not believe. And that wasn't allowed in this case, especially in the 355th in Judge Ralph Walton's court. He would not have allowed that.
All right, thank you very much. Well, we appreciate you coming on this way to argue. It's been very helpful. We appreciate your briefing. The case is submitted, and first session of 2010. May I be adjourned?
All right.